Well, it's very lovely to see all of you here tonight. Yeah, it's really lovely giving a talk to friends. I was just feeling that as I was sitting meditating. Can you hear me at the back? Can you hear me? Oh, I'll try and speak up a little bit louder. Okay. So, Vyapada Veramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. That's the ninth precept in its negative form. I undertake the training principle which consists in abstention from hatred. Or changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. Okay. So, a disclaimer. I'm going to quote quite a lot from the Bodhicharyavatara, which I believe, at the beginning, says that I'm not going to say anything new. And if Shantideva didn't say anything new in the Bodhicharyavatara, I'm certainly not going to say anything new tonight. But hopefully it will still be helpful just hearing things in a different way. So what I want to do is, firstly, I want to look just briefly at sort of different types of hatred or ill will. Then I want to start to look more deeply into what the nature of it is. So when we're experiencing hatred or ill will, what's going on actually? And then a little bit about what we can do about it. And then at the end, a little bit on actually turning hatred into compassion. And we can talk about turning hatred into compassion in quite a general way. I mean, in a sense, if we're just letting go of hatred and cultivating compassion, we're changing hatred into compassion. And that will be a whole other talk or set of talks. But actually, I want to make a connection between the two. So I want to actually sort of talk a bit about how we can change a mindset of hatred into a mindset of compassion. I want to make some connections. So yeah, firstly, a bit upon different sort of types or categories of hatred or ill will. It's not a very pleasant topic there, sorry. But that's how it is. So, hatred is vyapada or vyapada or pratika. And Bhante makes a very important distinction in places between hatred and anger. And what he says is that anger can be simply energy wanting to sort of burst through an obstacle, a bit like sort of frustration, if you like. And that can sometimes be allied with a real care and concern for somebody. If you see someone who's really letting themselves down, someone you know who's really letting themselves down in a big way, you might actually get really angry with them for doing that. And that's coming from your metta rather than from ill will. But so often, anger does have ill will in it. I think we've got to be very, very cautious with that kind of separation. It's true, it's valid, but we need to be cautious or we end up rationalising our ill will and saying, oh, it's actually not unskillful. So we've got a lovely variety of variations. There's rage, krodha. Something just bursts out. There's spikiness or spitefulness, pradasha, when we're really wanting to get at somebody. There's envy or jealousy, which also includes craving, when we're wanting something that someone else has got and we sort of resent them for having it. There's resentment. Yeah, we're sort of holding on to the ill will, we're sort of holding the grudge, and it just sort of continues perhaps for long periods of time. There's enmity, when that becomes even more hardened into an attitude towards somebody or towards a group of people. There's also malice or cruelty. I've dropped the Sanskrit, haven't I? It doesn't matter. Malice or cruelty, vihingsa. So we've got an order member, haven't we? Ahingsaka. So sort of non-cruelty. His name's connected with non-cruelty. So vihingsa, malice or cruelty. Actually, what I'm going to say in this talk doesn't fully fit that. It's got a somewhat different nature, because it's actually taking pleasure in causing harm. You could also list other things. Indignation. Yeah. Impatience. Fury. Defensiveness. Yeah, all sorts of things. And more broadly, we could speak of aversion, where we're not sort of wanting to harm, but we want to kind of avoid something or somebody. Yeah, that's a broader sort of state of mind. And hatred, I mean, it's usually directed towards people. We could also speak of hatred more broadly than that. I mean, there's getting really annoyed with the weather, for example, isn't there? And we really don't want it to carry on another baking hot afternoon. Maybe it's a bit of a stretch to call that ill will, but it's not a dissimilar state of mind if we're really uptight about it. And I was tempted, because I thought it's quite a serious talk about hatred, isn't it? Hatred is quite a serious subject. So I was thinking about sort of humour, and I was very tempted to bring in the recording of the bit from Fawlty Towers where Basil Fawlty is getting really enraged with his car and starts beating his car, but I thought that would be purely gratuitous, so I thought I wouldn't include that. And there's also self-hatred. So many of these different states of mind can actually be turned inwards, and they can be directed towards us, and come back to that a bit. And so they're a very ugly bunch, aren't they? Yeah, something about hatred is just really ugly. I find that quite interesting, that if you see someone in a sort of hateful state of mind, they look sort of relatively ugly. It'd be interesting to explore that. I'm not going to, but yeah. And in contrast, compassion is something just very, very beautiful, isn't it? Compassion is just a very moving thing when we really hold compassion, not pity, but real, real compassion. So, why bother changing hatred into compassion? Well, that's probably pretty obvious. But just in summary, the Bodhicaryavatara, I'm not going to give you the full quote, but it says how hatred destroys our practice, our spiritual practice. It prevents us from experiencing peace of mind and sleep. It prevents us from experiencing delight or even pleasure. And nobody around us likes us or respects us when we're in the grip of hatred. In short, there is no sense in which someone prone to anger is well off. So there's no shortage of reasons, and that's not all of them, to really work on hatred and ill will. So what I'd like to do now, and this is going to be the main section of my talk, really, it's what I'm going to spend by far the most time on, is start to look into what the nature of hatred really is. And I'm sure there's many ways we could do this. I'm just going to take a particular angle on it. And along the way, I'm hoping to uncover some clues about how we might work with hatred, and how in particular we might transform it more into compassion, or how compassion might arise. And I want to start with a quote from Know Your Mind. So Bhante says, "Hatred arises from paranoia, the feeling that others have it in for us, and from an insistence on finding a source for our suffering. It is the rage of the victim for redress. It is the way we avoid taking ultimate responsibility for the state we find ourselves in." After I finished writing this talk, I realised that's the only quote from Bhante I've got in this talk, which is a bit embarrassing, but it is the key quote, so I'm going to read it again. "Hatred arises from paranoia, the feeling that others have it in for us, and from an insistence on finding a source for our suffering. It is the rage of the victim for redress. It is the way we avoid taking ultimate responsibility for the state we find ourselves in." So paranoia is a strong word, isn't it? It says hatred arises from paranoia. And I think he's using that word loosely, but I think it's a real truth in that. So paranoia, there's that notion that other people are kind of maybe not got it in for us exactly, but and not taking us into account, that's quite a natural thing for us to do, because we're self-centered human beings. If we're short of stream entry anyway, we're self-oriented human beings. We interpret the world around us on the whole in terms of us, and so it's not surprising that we'll then start feeling that we're under attack, even when actually we're not at all. I mean, a very simple sort of example of this would be if you sort of hear someone laughing at you. Sorry, if you hear someone laughing, maybe a stranger, and your mind can just immediately go, "Oh, are they laughing at me?" I mean, that's kind of paranoia in a way, isn't it? You know, and we usually dismiss that, but that's the sort of thing which can give rise to ill will. So, as Bhante says, there's pain, there's some sort of painful experience, and we're looking for a source for it. We're looking for, well, why is there this painful experience? And we find this, the cause of our suffering, in somebody else. You know, this is what happens with hatred and ill will. We're having a painful experience, and we find the source, as it were, in somebody else. Self-hatred, of course, we see it in us, don't we? So what I want to focus on is the word victim. So Bhante says it's the rage of the victim for redress. Yeah? So when we're in a state of ill will, we're seeing ourselves as a victim. Someone's done something that they shouldn't have done, and we've been hurt. You know, it's we make ourselves into a victim. A sort of a self-pity underneath it. So the Dhammapada says, those who entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. So that's what gets at the root of it, doesn't it? Yeah, we think, he's done that, and I'm hurt, and a bit sort of indignant, and we're holding on to that position of being a victim of this other person's action. It's basically an adult version of, it's not fair! So it's very obvious in experiences of resentment, isn't it? If we're in a resentful state, which is something that's sort of perpetuated, we're keeping on turning over in our mind how we've been hard done by, how that person shouldn't have spoken to us in that way, and they should have known better, and etc., etc. Or you could think in terms of road rage. Yeah? I find it quite interesting how even really good Buddhists can sometimes be afflicted by road rage, something like getting behind the wheel of a car. You can just bring out something in some people, can't it? And I'm pleased to say I don't get that, but I have experienced similar things. Even just something simple like, I'm quite a fast walker generally, and if a crowd gets in front of me on the pavement, I kind of get a bit irritated and a bit sort of, they shouldn't have stepped in like that. They should know. Yeah, they should know. They should have been more aware of me. They should have been more sensitive to me. Me. So the Bodhicharavatara again. Consuming the food of dejection prepared by doing the undesirable and thwarting the desirable, biting hatred strikes me down. So that's a little bit obscure. So I'm going to give you another translation of that verse. Getting what I do not want and all that hinders my desire, there my mind finds fuel for misery. Anger springs from it, oppressing me. So what that's saying, it's the same thing as the Dhammapada quote, basically. It's saying that, well, if we don't get what we want, or if something gets in the way of what we want, then we start to turn that into a story, and that builds up the anger. That's the fuel. It's the fuel of dejection. Yeah, that making ourselves into a victim, which fuels our hatred. Okay, So I want to go a little bit deeper still into this. So again, just that bit from Know Your Mind. Bhante says, hatred is the way we avoid taking responsibility. We avoid taking ultimate responsibility for the state that we're in. So that suggests something quite sort of existential, doesn't it? It suggests something ultimate responsibility. We're not really taking responsibility for our situation. So it made me think about the Four Noble Truths. That's what I'm going to mainly talk about now. So there's the medical formula, isn't there? Yeah? In connection with the Four Noble Truths. So you've got the symptom of the disease, the thing that's wrong that you're experiencing. You've got the cause. You've got the prognosis, the potential for, the prognosis, let's say. And then you've got the treatment. So we could look at that. We could look at hatred in those terms. So we could talk in a way about the four ignoble truths. So when we're experiencing ill will, what's our version of those? Yeah. So the first noble truth, the truth of what's wrong is I'm suffering and I shouldn't be. Basically, that's what it is. And then the second one is, and it's their fault. Yeah. So I wanted to sort of unpack this a bit. So we can tend to think that dukkha shouldn't happen. Yeah, we're living in this modern world. It's all very comfortable. We've got probably most of what we need on a material level. We can go into the shop and buy anything we want, at least up to a certain point. And we live very comfortably. We've got so much choice in our lives. And on a material level, we don't probably experience that much dukkha. But not only that, we've got all these adverts on, you know, the internet probably now more, isn't it, rather than television. We've got all these adverts showing us what life should be like, as it were. You know, presenting us a sort of very rosy-tinted picture of this, you know, beautiful home and this perfect partner and family and a wonderful career and all the rest of it. And all of that can make us feel that when our life isn't like that, when we're experiencing unsatisfactoriness, that it shouldn't be happening. Yeah, we shouldn't be feeling unsatisfactoriness. We should be feeling pleasure and fulfilment and happiness all the time. But of course, that's not how it is, is it? That's not how that's not actually how reality is. Dukkha is part and parcel of life, but it can be hard to accept when we experience it. So what we often do is we argue with the facts. So maybe. I mean, I live in a community, as Rakesh mentions, and actually it's a wonderful community. It really is. I'm very pleased that I've got four of my community brothers here tonight. But of course, in a community, inevitably there are little things you don't quite like. And I can get sort of just a little bit irritated with the washing up that's been left out. Actually, it doesn't really bother me that much these days, but the washing up that's been left out, or something that's not in the right place, or whatever it is. And it's like, oh, they shouldn't have done that. They should have washed up after themselves, or whatever it is. Or they shouldn't have spoken to me like that. Actually, that's not really a problem in our community. And when we say those sorts of things, what do we mean? So they shouldn't have done the washing up. Sorry, they should have done the washing up. Get right around. But they haven't. So what does it mean to say they should have done it? What it basically means is that I'm not happy with the fact they haven't done it, and I can't really accept they haven't done it. They should have done it. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's actually arguing with the facts of the situation. Mm-hmm. We're trying to recreate a past in which something different happened. And when we do the old, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me. There's an implicit kind of, he shouldn't have done that, should have known better than to do that, should have taken me into account properly. But what happened is what happened. So it's not really accepting the dukkha, actually accepting that that's our experience. As I said, it's I'm suffering and I shouldn't be. And it shouldn't have happened. There's a very good booklet, I don't know if any of you have come across it, by Ajahn Sumedho on the Four Noble Truths. It's actually available online. I think I've got a link on the handout. And he frames the First Noble Truth not as, very specifically makes the point, it's not I am suffering, it's there is suffering. If you like, if that sounds a bit too alienated, you could say, there is suffering in my experience. Yeah. But when we say I'm suffering, we make it very personal. It's something, it's me, it's something that's happening to me. And we forget that dukkha is just a fact of life, and everyone experiences it. So the First Noble Truth is really just to recognise there is suffering. That's just how it is. Yeah, this is an experience of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, suffering. And I was thinking in this connection of the Kisagotomi story. So you can look at the change in her relationship to suffering through that story. Mm. So at the beginning of the story, she's denying the suffering, isn't she? She's not able to accept that she's in pain, that she's lost her son. But then through going to the Buddha and then talking to people and hearing the experiences of their loss, she gradually comes to realise that dukkha, that bereavement happens to everybody. Yeah? So that changes her relationship to her suffering profoundly. So that could be something useful to reflect on. Ajahn Sumedho says that what we need to do with the experience of dukkha is to actually just be with it, to stand under it. Yeah? Understand comes from root meaning, to stand under. Which is quite a good phrase. To really accept the suffering, stand under or embrace it, rather than just react to it. It's easier said than done, isn't it? But that's the work. And I know from my own experience that when I'm in a painful state of mind, I can easily sort of try and distract myself from it, or that's probably what I mainly do, try and distract myself from it. But when I actually come back to my experience and just sit with it, just be with it, after usually quite a short period of time, there's a relief in actually just properly experiencing it, and there's a satisfaction even in just being with the experience, even though it's not pleasant, which is better than the sort of alienated trying to escape from it. Yeah, so when we're telling ourselves all this, they shouldn't have done this, or I shouldn't have done this, that's the other variation, in a very sort of, not in a taking responsibility way, but in a kind of, I shouldn't have done this. We're denying the noble truth of dukkha, that this is something that happens. I came across a very interesting quote, very short, but I'll just give it to you, about forgiveness, which I'm going to come back to. It's anonymous. Forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past.
Say that again.
Forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. It's not rational, that, but it kind of makes certain sense, doesn't it? Alright, so second noble truth. I've got quite a bit on this, so I'm going to be much briefer with the other two. So the second noble truth. So the second ignoble truth is it's their fault that I'm experiencing this painful state, or it's my fault, but in a way which isn't really taking responsibility. And again, Naropa, samsara is the tendency to find fault with others. So if we're in samsara, this is what we're going to do, to find fault with others. We blame. Yeah, so we're not taking responsibility, we're wanting an easy answer, it's their fault. That means I can just resent them for it and feel sorry for myself that I've had this experience, but I don't have to really do anything about it. Yeah, I don't really have to own my part in the experience. So yeah, I'm casting myself as the victim and the other person as sort of the perpetrator. And it is a kind of not taking responsibility for ourselves. I mean, I thought one example of this is somebody who, I'm not thinking of a particular person, I don't know anyone quite like this, I don't think, but somebody who blames their parents for everything that's gone wrong in their lives. You can imagine, I'm not sure if I've actually met anyone quite like that, but it's some sort of thing you can read about in stories. Someone's sort of completely caught up in what might genuinely have been a very difficult childhood, to the point of actually just blaming the parents for everything. And of course we can do that with other people as well, can't we? All right. So another aspect of this is that we're taking selves too literally, yeah, when we're blaming. So suppose somebody's spoken to me very harshly, I then become a real self who's a victim of harsh speech, and they're a real bad person who've done what they've done and shouldn't have acted in that way. So I make myself very real in sort of a fixed and concrete sort of way, and I make them very real as if they're sort of a thing that's made a decision, like I'm going to speak harshly to Sima Dragosha. So do you see what I mean? It's very sort of solid, isn't it? It's very sort of literal. And of course that's not actually how things are. We are not fixed selves, and neither are the other people in whatever the situation is. So I want to read something from Rob Bobea's Seeing That Frees. And it's an example that he's given of a situation in which to illustrate this. So this is quite a long quote, it's a story. So he says, perhaps, for example, you're with a friend and she is telling you of some difficulty she is going through. You are listening as attentively and sympathetically as you can, but at the same time, you're also aware of some disquiet within yourself. In response to what your friend is sharing with you, surely, you vaguely worry to yourself, you should be feeling more empathy and compassion. Yet somehow you are left mostly unmoved. Later this bothers you, and you wonder if there is something wrong with you, perhaps suspecting that your capacity for empathy is small, that you are, after all this practice, rather a cold-hearted person. I'm sure none of us do this to ourselves. That way of looking, focusing only on yourself and holding the self responsible for how things went, fails to see and take into account a whole range of other factors that contributed significantly to limiting the extent of the compassion that you felt at that time. The rather unfulfilling connection may simply have been a result of something as basic as being tired from overwork or for any other reason. Believing that you should be feeling more, however, and pressuring yourself subtly or judging yourself, the cues of tiredness are likely to be discounted. What's more, the pressure you put on yourself to feel something is also itself more likely to strangle any emotional resonance that might have arisen. So when we start judging ourselves, we make it harder to respond with empathy. Of course, there could be other much more complex reasons. Maybe there's some tension with the person, maybe a slight tension from a previous experience, or maybe it's something to do with the way she's speaking, but even though you're not really noticing that. So there could be any number of reasons why, in a given situation, we don't connect with somebody and we don't feel empathy. But we can get into self-blame. So this is an example of self-blame. But the same thing happens with other people, when we're blaming other people. We're not imagining or not aware of the other conditions that have led them to act in the way that they've acted. So to give a personal example of this, I've been swimming quite regularly recently over the last couple of years. This last year I've noticed I've been at the pool at the same time as a certain young man who is quite a wide lane that I usually swim in, because it's the slow lane. But this particular young man, he swims diagonally across the lane instead of going clockwise, as you're requested to do by the sign. Being the sort of person I am, I get a little bit irritated by this. Like, you should be swimming clockwise, you know, not taking me into account, blah, blah, blah. Actually, it really isn't that difficult to work around. But then at some point I realised, actually, I don't think he's entirely with it mentally. And soon after realising that, I realised that he always comes with an older man who I think is his father. They share a dressing cubicle, and that seems to be the case, actually. And of course, when I realise that changes my attitude. Shanti Davis says, "Whatever transgressions and evil deeds of various kinds there are, all arise through the power of conditioning factors, while there is nothing that arises independently. Therefore, even if one sees a friend or an enemy behaving badly, one can reflect there are specific conditioning factors that determine this and thereby remain happy." So, okay, that's looking at the cause of suffering in terms of a whole mass of different conditions that are coming together, which we just dismiss when we're getting into blaming somebody or blaming ourselves. But the second noble truth, of course, points to something more specific, doesn't it? Yeah, it says that the real cause of our suffering is our own craving. It's our own wanting things to be other than they actually are. Yeah, all of that shoulding, they should have done this, I should have done that, etc. That's actually very painful. That's the real dukkha. Actually, is when we get into that sort of state of mind. I don't know if you're familiar with the image the Buddha gives of he says, anger is like holding a coal. It's like you picked up a coal from a furnace and you're holding it ready to throw it at somebody. But yeah, who's getting burnt? Yeah, you are. So similarly, again, I told you lots of Bodhicharyavatara in this. Shantideva says, "Here's the knife and mine the body, the twofold cause of suffering. He has grasped the knife, I my body. At which is there anger?" That's pretty strong, isn't it? It's almost outrageous. Someone's attacked you or stabbed you with a knife, and he's saying, well, yep, that person's grasped the knife, but you've grasped your body. It's basically talking about rebirth. And they've combined to produce this experience of suffering. So this might be a bit outrageous if we take it on a literal level, but actually it's really interesting and relevant if we take it on a more metaphorical level. Yeah? If you take it into words, for example, well, someone speaks harshly to me. Okay, they've grasped that speech, but I'm the one who's grasping the, they shouldn't have done that, they're not taking me into account. After all I've done for them, or whatever it is. That's just as much grasping. As what the other person's done, and if I wasn't doing that, I wouldn't be experiencing dukkha in the same way. So I think that knife body thing, the stronger it is just an excellent metaphor for what we do when we get into blaming other people. In fact, often I find if I get irritated, often I think my irritation is more unskillful than whatever it is I'm irritated about. In fact, often what I'm irritated about isn't unskillful at all, like the example of the swimmer. I very much doubt that person's actually in an unskillful state of mind. So that's quite sobering. I find that actually a really useful reflection. Okay, I'm experiencing ill will. I've maybe got an idea the other person's acted very badly, but what about me? What about the state of mind that I'm in now? Yeah, Shantideva again. Some commit offences out of delusion, others, deluded, grow angry. Who among them should we say is free from blame, or who should we say is guilty? Alright, so what about the other two noble truths? I'm going to deal with these two together. So the cessation of suffering and the way to go about it. So I've not got a particularly clear idea about what the third and fourth ignoble truths might be. But I think probably it's something like, I'm stuck with this unless I can get them back. That's probably what it often is. We can kind of feel like we've got to kind of express that anger and bring them down a peg or two, or at least make them apologise, at least make them see how much pain we're in. That's often what it is, isn't it? And then maybe it'll be all right. Yeah. But of course, the real truth about cessation is that we can transcend this, we can rise above it, we can let go of that dukkha. Bhante says, a positive state of mind is never that far away. I was wrong, there's another quote. A positive state of mind is never that far away. And it's very easy to forget that and not believe that. So I just want to review what we've already covered in terms of what we can do about states of ill will. So firstly, there's that thing about letting go of the victim story. Yeah. So to give you the other Dhamma part of us, those who do not entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will still their hatred. That's what's keeping it going. We let that story go, if we let the story go, we'll probably be free of it. Yeah? Well, we will be, I think, unless it's actually so deep that there isn't really a conscious story. That's another matter. Actually, Marcus Aurelius, I found a similar quote. Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher emperor, said, reject your sense of injury and the injury itself disappears. That's basically saying the same thing, isn't it? And then there was that whole thing about the fuel of dejection, wasn't there? So the same sort of area. How when we're telling ourselves these stories about how we've not got what we want and so on, that is making us feel dejected or miserable, and that's fueling our hatred. So Shantideva says, therefore I will utterly destroy the sustenance of this, my enemy, my foe, that's the hatred, whose sole intention is to bring me injury and sorrow. So come what may, I'll never harm my cheerful happiness of mind. So he's basically saying, stay in a positive state of mind. Stay in a, I think it's probably more positive than cheerful and happy necessarily. Yes, stay in a positive state of mind. See that as what you need to do. And if you can just not lose the initiative with that, well, you won't succumb to states of ill will. So that may be a bit optimistic for some of us, to always be in a positive state of mind. But if we are in a somewhat positive state of mind, we probably do find that we are letting go of the seeds of ill will quite quickly and easily. That can be an interesting thing to notice, that if you're feeling positive and something happens which would normally annoy you, it doesn't bother you as much, or if at all. But to actually notice that, oh, it makes a difference, actually. So I think we probably could be a little bit more specific with that. I was listening to a talk by Papavajra on those Dhammapada verses, and he talks about the need to really sort of activate ourselves, the need to really sort of, I can't remember exactly what he says about it, but he's basically talking about really coming from a place of Shraddha, really living our lives by what's most important to us, so that we feel empowered about our lives, we feel happy about how we're behaving, what we're doing with our lives. And if we do that, we're much less likely to succumb to thoughts of ill will, because that victim state is just not, it just doesn't accord with the way in which we're relating to our experience. Actually, what came to mind is, I think Ratnagosha is a good exemplar of this. I think there was somebody who probably by temperament isn't particularly prone to irritation or ill will, but I don't think I've ever seen Ratnagosha in a sort of a state of ill will, and I suspect that it's at least partly connected to the fact that he's just doing what's most important to him with his life. That's what he's given his life to, and that's a whole change of mindset with that. You can tell me later if I've got that right. So letting go of the victim story is one thing we can do. And then there's just noticing and remembering that dukkha happens. Yeah, it's just a part of life. Even being treated badly happens. It's just going to happen. Because other people are as other people are. And it's not personal. That means it's not personal. It's not something we need to identify with as mine, whereas everyone else is all right, as it were, whereas I'm suffering. Thirdly, we can reflect on all the different conditioning factors that give rise to an experience of dukkha. So rather than blaming somebody else, or rather than blaming ourselves, we can just recognise or imagine all the different things that have given rise to what's to the actual experience. It's not just them deciding to be nasty for some strange reason. And then there's recognising that the key thing about our suffering is we are wanting things to be different. Yeah? There's recognising the craving that's going on, and that's the real dukkha in our experience. And it's karmic, and the more we do that, the more we'll continue to develop that tendency. Yeah, so that can be a quite salutary reflection. Do I really want to be more like this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you get into a state of particularly resentment, yeah, do I really want to perpetuate this? Actually, I seem to have skipped over this in my notes. I wanted to briefly mention, probably my strongest experience of failing to work in this area, which was before I moved to Cambridge, when I was in a very difficult dynamic with another order member. And I won't go into that. That wouldn't be appropriate, but I was quite angry with what was going on, with what I saw as what he was doing. But I couldn't, I wasn't able to express that. I was afraid to express that. So I got into this really horrible, resentful state, which lasted for many months, actually. I mean, of course, I did try to work with it, but I didn't succeed very well. And it did destroy my practice. It did just bring me into a situation where I was just really struggling to meditate effectively, not because I had the stories going on all the time, but just the state I was in generally. It was just bringing me down, losing touch with my inspiration, losing confidence. It was a really horrible period of my life, actually. And I wasn't fully recognising how unskillful my own state of mind was. I was kind of feeling that, well, because I'm not sort of expressing it, I felt almost I had a bit of a moral high ground. But actually, in terms of on the mental level, what I was doing was probably more unskillful, actually, than what I was upset about. So that was very salutary. So lastly, I want to talk a little bit about changing hatred into compassion. Now, I talked briefly to Arthur Prior earlier about this, about why it's changing hatred into compassion rather than changing hatred into love. Because after all, love is perhaps the obvious opposite of hatred. And I'll come back to that, but hatred and compassion, in a way, they're opposite responses to suffering. So in hatred, in a state of hatred or ill will, let's say, we feel, I'm suffering, I shouldn't be, it's their fault, as I've been saying. And wanting to get back at the other person in some way, even if it's just in our own mind. Whereas with compassion, we're really experiencing the dukkha, or imagining it if it's somebody else's dukkha. And we're able to be with that in a state of mind which isn't about us at all. Yeah. And even perhaps recognising the universality of it. Mm-hmm. When, if we're in a state of compassion, we're in touch with what it is to be human, actually. Mm-hmm. But there's that dukkha is something that's universal, at least on some level. Certainly amongst unenlightened beings. Mm-hmm. So, we say, don't we, that compassion arises when metta meets another being suffering. Yeah, that's the way we normally talk about compassion. So obviously we can use metta-bhavana as a way of working with this precept. But what I've been doing in a way in this talk is looking at the other end, which is the sort of suffering end. So you could say that compassion arises when we become aware of another being suffering in a state of mind that's not self-oriented. That's sort of another way of saying something very similar. Though sometimes another person's suffering can just break into our self-orientation. Sometimes it can just come in, even when we're not already in a particularly positive state. So there is a connection between the two, between hatred and suffering. There's an important connection. Arthur Prior's answer to this question about why it's compassion, not love, was that, well, it can be hard to turn ill will into love. If we're in a state of ill will, resentment, or whatever it is, it can be quite hard to just sort of turn that round, turn it into metta. But if we can connect with the suffering of the other person, then there's more of a possibility of compassion arising. So maybe the reason why compassion is on a practical level, compassion is what we can perhaps, at least sometimes, more easily transform hatred into. So this is to do with forgiveness, isn't it? It's to do with letting go of that victim state and seeing things in a completely different way. Not easy, but this is taking responsibility. So I want to finish with two excerpts from two stories. They're quite strong stories. I'm just going to give you a bit of background and then read quote. So the first one is by someone called Marion Partington. And this story you can find in Vishvapani's book Challenging Times. It first appeared in Dharma Life, and Challenging Times is excerpts from the Dharma Life magazine that was. And Marianne Partington is the sister of Lucy Partington, and she was one of the young women who was abducted and murdered by Fred and Rosemary West in the early 1970s. And in the book, Marianne writes about how 20 years afterwards, so there was a long period where they didn't know what had happened to Lucy. She just disappeared. It was much, much later when her body was found. So it must have been an extremely difficult thing to live with for all that time. And even after she realised what had happened, so much later, she then had to work through all of the rage that she initially felt. But she, during the same period, she was becoming a Buddhist, or at least she was going on Buddhist retreats. So she was on a Chan retreat and had a breakthrough in her relationship with what had happened. And by this time, this is relevant to understanding the quote, Fred West had actually already killed himself. He was in prison and he had killed himself. So that's why she's only referring to Rosemary. So she says, after returning to my cushion, so she's on retreat, I had a startling insight into Rosemary West's great suffering. Locked away for life, isolated, demonised, estranged from her children. As if for the first time, I empathised deeply with her tragic position. I found myself praying that my pain would relieve hers. All my suffering dissolved. I had lived with this burning question of how to feel compassion for someone who had ruined my life. And in that moment, I knew. I experienced a spacious, open heart where forgiving is spontaneous. So isn't that credible? She was able to really empathise with this person. And that, she says, all my suffering dissolved, just being able to actually bring empathy to that incredibly difficult situation. So if she can do it, we can. The second example is somebody called Colleen Haggerty, and this is from a TEDx talk. And so the backstory is that at 17 years old, this woman was in a car driven by her sister, as it happens, and they had an accident. And the accident left the car in the outside lane facing the wrong way. This is in the States. Nobody stopped to help. So after a while, she got out of the car to try to flag down help, and then there was this other car coming at ridiculous speed towards them, and basically the next thing she knew, she'd lost her lower leg. Mm. Yeah. And again, a very long time of just working with the upset and the blame and so on around that. So she says in this talk, I spent a number of sessions with my therapist, arming myself with all the words I wanted to say to him. So she's going to meet the man who drove the car. And unbeknownst to my therapist, I plotted my revenge. While I knew I couldn't rip him apart limb to limb in public, a good chest beating felt perfectly appropriate. I couldn't wait to see Harvey and give him his due. When I saw Harvey, I didn't beat him up. I didn't yell and scream at him. I listened. I heard about what happened during the accident from his perspective, why he made the decisions he made that day. I learned that, given everything he knew in that moment, he did the best he could. I heard how the accident impacted his life, ulcers, a divorce, Jekyll and Hyde personality. I was all ready to rub it in his face how the accident had affected my life, but after hearing how it had impacted his, I didn't have the heart. I met two people that day, Harvey and my compassionate self. I'm not going to pretend any of this was easy for me. It wasn't. But when I saw that I was capable of seeing the situation from his perspective and even had empathy, I felt a freedom I had never known before. And when I forgave Harvey, I actually felt empowered. Nothing on the outside had changed. I still didn't have my leg. It still hurt to walk. I was still stared at all the time. But so much on the inside had changed. Do these bitter feelings still come up? Absolutely. But now, I don't allow them to define me as a victim. I allow them to remind me to forgive again and again and again. I've had other occasions to forgive, and each time when I forgive, I open the door to the possibility of being more of who I am meant to be.